as the airplane became more and more heavy, and we're trying to get all the data points and two engines running and get some matrix to find out the exact precise speed and RPM and manifold pressure and ultra lean burn, the pilot and the air crew was really, really heavy. Was very, very busy about collecting this data because we had to fly the airplane precisely. Because remember the dream about ending up 100 miles short? Had to get every single centimeter out of every gram of fuel aboard this airplane. And that was our task at that time. But as we kept putting more and more fuel on it, the airplane became more and more sensitive to fly. The last flight that I flew it before the World Flight Takeoff, that was the heaviest we ever flew it in flight test, that it was so sensitive to fly that you'd sit there and you'd hold the stick and you'd just, it's just right on the very edge and you'd be holding it and then you'd have to change the frequencies to somebody. And then you'd think, okay, it's 121.72. Okay, 121.72. Okay, there's the radio. Okay, here we go. 121. Oh, God, oh, sugar. Okay, we got it dampened out again. Okay, we got it now. Okay, now we put in the other frequency. Now, you can imagine my feeling at that time when we were going to put in 20%, round numbers, 20% more fuel. And if this particular situation became worse and worse, I had extreme doubts that even the world's greatest velvet-armed test pilot could even fly the airplane. It was unflyable. That was the thing that really bothered me most of all. But I tell you what, I was tired. I wanted this whole program over with. I just bloody wanted it over with. And when I released that little tiny brake on the nose wheel that morning, and I remember that you gave me a couple of acceleration checkpoints. He says, when you cross here, you must have this number. But the last one was at midfield, and I looked at the data. I just got the data from the archives, and it was 68 knots. And he says, Dick, if you don't have 68 knots by midfield, you got to abort because you're not going to make it. And after we put the extra fuel on, he'd maybe do a blood oath. He was telling me, Dick, you got to abort. And I said, yes, I promise I'll do that, Bert, I promise it. But in my own mind, when I released brakes that morning, there was no fine way that I was going to quit under any circumstance whatsoever. And I wanted the damn thing over with. And as we went down the acceleration, and like Bert said, Gina's job was to call out, although we did actually hear him. I could hear Mike telling me that you got wingtips on the ground. Really? But we came up to midfield that
why
last...
Why didn't you pull the stick back then?
Okay, now here's the situation. And you were right, Bert, but we're accelerating, and the biggest thing in my mind was that this thing is going to get out of sorts in the oscillation.
Yeah.
And it was bad enough in flight that I could barely fly it, but I had no idea what the oscillation and the damping characteristics would be with it sitting on three landing gear. It could be totally different.
Yep.
And in my mind, I thought that I could not handle that. It was one of my biggest fears on the takeoff. It was midfield at 68 knots. And I rolled down the runway that morning, and the midfield marker came by, and it was 64 knots. And we were 4 knots low at midfield. And I called it out. I says, 4 knots low at midfield. And I thought, I just promised Bert, under any circumstances, that I was going to abort.
And that's why I said I didn't think he'd make it.
Yeah, well, that's true. But then... But the thing is, then Mike was hollering. I could hear him hollering, Dick, you got a wingtips on the ground. Pull back on the stick, Dick. Pull back on the stick. And I thought, the challenge to try to bring those wings up while I'm still on the takeoff roll was more than I could do it. And the fact that they were, this big fear about this out-of-control oscillations, the wings were down, and they were scraping on the ground, and they were bloody stable. Then I didn't give a damn about the whole thing. They were down, and they were stable. Now, when Gina... Another thing Gina did to me that morning, too, is that she was going to call the speeds. And I remember it was something like, 88 knots or 92 knots was the rotation speed.
86,
somewhere in that area, but I let it run a little bit more for grandma. Yep. It's, you know, most pilots do that, too. And then Gina was calling those speeds out. And right at the most critical time in the whole thing, her hand froze on the transmitter. And, of course, if she's transmitting and nobody's talking, we can't hear anything. And so during this rotation that I'm trying to bring that thing up just as smooth, I said, Dick, if you've never been smooth any time in your life, you better be smooth right now, baby. This is the big one. And I pulled him up really slow, and at the same time, I'm batting her hand off the mic button, turning around, trying to get her to let go of the transmit button for a while. And then it finally come up, and then pretty soon I can actually see the wingtips over the booms. And then it kept coming up higher and higher and higher. And I thought, oh my God, they're going to touch over my head. And it scared me so bad that I went down so I couldn't see them anymore. And I tell you what, that morning, that Borger, she lifted off and flew in ground effect. And as soon as it got airborne and we were in ground effect, just a couple of feet as we're accelerating out to 100 knots, I thought, I got 100 knots. And I called it, I guess, Gina called it, and I got 100 knots. But the thing was that I was saying to Gina, I said, Gina, look. And she's laying on her back and looking up at me like, well, yeah, I knew it all the time. I wish you'd have told me that, because I didn't know.
At that moment, remember, we had this information that you, 4 knots slow, you still go. At that moment, I noticed that you were flying really low. And I thought that you weren't accelerating, because if you were, you'd have got maybe 3 or 4 feet off the ground.
Oh, out of ground.
The fact that you were sitting there, I thought that you were probably locked in at 87 knots couldn't go anymore. That's why I was so damn excited and relieved.
You got 100 knots.
You got 100 knots. And that, you know, the tape, I hate to listen to it. It sounds like some idiot. But we got 100 knots. You know, right then, I knew we would not have a problem with a climb out.
That's right. And what the climb was, if you're doing this, 50 foot a minute rate of climb would have been golden. 50 foot a minute rate of climb, we'd all been just thrilled to that. And I sat there, locked onto 100 knots on the climb schedule, and I saw the rate of climb go up to 50 feet. Hey, cool. Then it went to 100 feet. Wow, 100 feet. Then it went to 200 feet, and it stabilized out at 300 foot per minute rate of climb. We could have taken more fuel.
Because you were decelerating. No.
Hey, guys.
No.
Hey, guys.
If you take a Voyager, anybody flown a Voyager? If you take a heavy Voyager and make the slightest, almost imperceptible acceleration or deceleration, it makes a big change in climb. But if I look at the data on your full power climb that you did going all the way to feet wet, you didn't have 300 feet a minute. You thought you did only because you were very slightly slowing down and you saw that 300 feet and said that, hey, we could have taken more fuel.
We got the gear up, too. That helped a lot.
Yeah.
And then we shook the wingtips and they shredded off.
Well, what
we
were
west,
looking at then.
And the rest is history.
What we were looking at then, we're looking at a wing. We're looking at a wing that's about that thick out near the tip. And as it gets near the winglet, it gets thinner and thinner, and it looked like it was about 1/4 inch thick at the winglet. Okay? And the winglet was wiggly. And we wanted to find out whether there's going to be any serious issues with that early. And we wanted to get good speed power data with the winglets off because we knew they weren't going to stay on very long. So we tried to get the winglets off as soon as possible so that we could get the data while the Duchess was still with you and get an idea on whether, with this damage, that you could still make it around
the world.
Now, one
thing is when the winglet came off in the local area on film,
yeah,
and the top skin would rip off.
Yeah.
If it ripped into that fuel cell, then that was the end of the mission.
Yeah.
And we wanted to do that where that happened in the local area. But that, anyway, it's a great story. But Bert, tell them about that last slide, about that little piece of stuff.
Okay, put up the last slide.
Last slide.
This is really, really neat, what he's got
here. I am very proud to say that this little piece, which was cut out of it's an autoclave piece of carbon fiber, which was cut out of the seat of Spaceship One on Tuesday, a week ago, flew by Pluto.
Wow.
It's hard for me to say that.
Wow.
But Alan Stern, the principal investigator of New Horizons, when he was getting this ready, we had not yet gotten the Spaceship One to the Air and Space Museum. We wanted it to come to Oshkosh one more time. And during that time, we wanted to take some things off of Spaceship One that were real expensive. But the Air and Space Museum says, ooh, no, you don't mess with that. I don't care how much expensive. This is a real museum, and real museums present airplanes as they did the record. In fact, we took Spaceship One, which we had fixed that wrinkle on the tail because it had radiative heat that caused it to buckle on one of Mike's flights. We took a heat gun and we straightened that out. And then I decided later, you know, it was wrinkled for the most important flight, which is not the XPRIZE flight. It was the June 21st flight, the very first non-government manned space flight. And we took and put the heat on it and wrinkled it again.
We did.
So you can see the airplane with a wrinkled tail. That looks exactly the way it landed on June 21st after that flight. But actually, it got straightened for the XPRIZE flights and insulated so it didn't wrinkle. And then we went back in and heated it up and wrinkled it again.
Now, that's really cool. That a part of
but anyway, Alan Stern called me. Alan Stern called and told me, he said, Bert, this is a different deep space probe than has ever been done by America. It's not a joint, it's not a JPL program. It's being done by commercial entities, too, a college. And I forget what the name of his company, if you remember it or if you know it, holler it out, but Alan Stern's research company, Southwest Research, something like that, in conjunction with a school. And there's elements of that program that are unlike any other deep space probe that the U.S. government taxpayer paid for, and there are elements about the program being commercial. Now, that doesn't mean that NASA and taxpayer funds didn't pay for it. Most of the money did come from NASA. But he felt strongly that he wanted to tie the two together, the fact that he was doing a more commercial-like approach to a deep space probe, that he felt the historic Spaceship One was a fully commercial manned spacecraft. He wanted a piece of it to put on New Horizons. And they put seven things on New Horizons for historical reasons. One of them was the ashes of Clyde Tombaugh, who discovered Pluto in 1930. Okay, and I've forgotten what the other five things were, but you can Google it and find out. But I remember I asked Alan Stern, well, can I talk about this? And he says, oh, yeah, it's fine. And so I put out, I've forgotten whether it was an email or something, and I got all this hate mail. Oh, yeah, Rutan, sure enough, you're going to have something go by Pluto. Oh, yeah. You know, we have a lot of these, especially the people that work for the government that like to throw darts and whatever. And I just smiled, and I knew that when it flew by Pluto, everybody would know. But
guys, we're out of time.
At any rate, we had a lot of enjoyment during a 9.5-year flight, and that it got there, and that a piece of Spaceship One is out at the Kuiper Belt now.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mike Melville, Dick Rutan, Bert Rutan. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you. Nick, you're going to